This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Good day. My name is Hayden Rampadarath. I'm a postdoc here at Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. And
I'm Jean-François Robitaille. I'm also a postdoc at the University of Manchester.
And for the last 2 days, we've been having part of the UK SETI Research Network. There's been lots of talks about SETI and very important discussions about the future and even current events. I also have two members, from Breakthrough Initiative, which is Jamie Drew, and Danny Price from Breakthrough Listen. So first of all, I'll pass it over to Jamie Drew, and he'll introduce himself and talk a little bit about Breakthrough Initiatives.
Certainly. So my name is Jamie Drew. I'm the Chief of Staff with the Breakthrough Prize Foundation and a Project Manager with the Breakthrough Initiatives. I may start by saying that the Breakthrough Initiatives were announced in July 20th at the Royal Society in 2015 with Stephen Hawking and Sir Martin Rees, as well as our Chairman, Dr. S. Pete Warden, and our primary sponsor, Mr. Yuri Milner. And the Breakthrough Initiatives, is kind of in one sentence, is really a philanthropic private program looking at searching for life in the universe and in all of its forms, and space exploration. We have announced a series of initiatives, but we're primarily here at the UK SETI Research Network Symposium to talk about SETI and our first initiative called Breakthrough Listen, which is a $100 million investment in the field of SETI. And we decided to contract UC Berkeley in sunny California to run that program. Of course, have Danny Price here from that program today. So,
Before we move over to Danny, in your talk you had mentioned about bringing SETI into the academic arena. Could you briefly talk about that? Like what do you really mean in that sense?
So SETI has been around for quite some time now. And in kind of an analysis of efforts of the past, there's a rich history of prominent figures and individuals and papers. SETI has not necessarily matured in the field of academic thought or academic institutions as a proper discipline. And so one of the primary objectives of the Breakthrough Initiatives is to make Breakthrough Listen the vehicle at which we provide the financial resources, the intellectual resources, and the people to make it a rigorous scientific discipline, bringing SETI into mainstream astronomy. That is our primary goal. And one measurement of that is peer-reviewed publications. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to involve ourselves internationally on the kind of publishing circuit, as well as at academic conferences, to really engage with the astronomy community on the field of SETI, finding its place in a more permanent way.
Right, yeah. That sounds very exciting, actually.
Maybe I have one question. So about, the philanthropy and the private sector. So we see it a lot those days with, for example, SpaceX, and you mentioned Bigelow as well, Aerospace or something. Yeah. Do you think it's the future of fundamental research in general, or...
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Most people's conscious of the space age is the likes of Yuri Gagarin or the first Apollo landings or Sputnik. That's the space age. But the space age really began hundreds of years prior to that with ground-based observations, astronomers doing the kind of monotonous and at times lonely work of staring at the stars. So your kind of Galileo to Gagarin period was dominated, interestingly enough, by a large contribution of private actors. That is to say, wealthy industrialists who put money into the field of space exploration, ground-based space exploration. So in sunny California, where the Breakthrough Initiatives are headquartered, we have an observatory called Lick Observatory. And James Lick was a wealthy industrialist at the time, 1800s, who decided that he would contribute nearly a fourth or third of his wealth. At first, he wanted to build a pyramid in downtown San Francisco, and he was convinced that perhaps he should put his money towards scientific pursuits. So he put it in the Lick Observatory. I think it was equivalent to about, in today's US dollars, about $1.2 billion of his net worth. And what you find during that period is the majority of of observatories in the United States were built through private means and private mechanisms. Early rocketry as well with Goddard. So today, as you mentioned, SpaceX, Bigelow and Jeff Bezos and other dynamic and wealthy individuals involved in what has been characterized as the new space age. This commercial attribute is not necessarily anything new. There's a wonderful book being published, I believe, this year or next year by Alex MacDonald that describes this as a reemergence of private investment in space. And the breakthrough initiatives are much in the same vein, a private institution following a long history of private investment in space exploration. Perhaps what makes us a bit unique is probably the first most kind of significant contribution to the field of SETI. Of course, there's been Paul Allen in the back with the Allen Telescope Array and the SETI Institute. But with the announcement of Breakthrough Starshot, which is looking at accelerating a small miniaturized probe to our nearest sun, 4.3 light years away, the Alpha Centauri system, looking at accelerating at a velocity of 20% light speed, would probably be the first philanthropic nonprofit organization that has a space mission, a space-based mission. So that's kind of exciting. But again, we come from a long history of long economic history of private investments in space exploration. So
thanks a lot, Jamie. So now we'll switch over to Danny Price, and we'll probably ask him to describe a little bit more of Breakthrough Listen, because it's the current actual work being done by Breakthrough Initiative. So, Danny.
Sure. Okay, well, so Breakthrough Listen is a 10-year, $100 million program to try and answer the question, are we alone in the universe? So it is a SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and we are using the best telescopes we can to make the most sensitive and widest bandwidth measurements that are possible. So the kind of first few telescopes we've been using have been the Parkes 64-meter telescope in New South Wales in Australia, the 100-meter aperture Greenbank telescope in West Virginia, which is one of the largest steerable structures in the world. The Chernobyl sarcophagus is now the largest movable structure in the world. And we're also using the APF telescope at Lick Observatory, which, as Jamie mentioned, Lick Observatory was originally funded via philanthropic means. So they're the three main telescopes we're using. The Breakthrough Foundation has agreements that we get a certain percentage of the time to do our SETI observations. The other aspect of it is that we've built new digital systems so that we can expand the capabilities of these telescopes in a way that hasn't been done before. So, for example, at Greenbank, we now have about half of our system installed, but when the full system is installed, we'll be able to record 10 gigahertz worth of bandwidth from the telescope instantly. And what that means is, in terms of searching the electromagnetic spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum is very wide. It goes from that 10 meter kind of wavelengths all the way up through to a couple of centimeters. There's a radio window there. And to cover that entire radio window traditionally required many different pointings with many different receivers. That takes a lot more time to do. What we want to do with Breakthrough Listen is to try and cover as much of the electromagnetic spectrum as possible with the fewest pointings of the telescope. And that just means it's a lot more efficient and you can cover a lot more ground. So if you imagine with FM radio, if you tune in, you move the dial slowly and you get to a particular frequency at which there's some information being broadcast. But if you can only view a little kind of narrow channel at once, if you're just going through with your headphones and you're twisting a dial, it'll be very slow and it will take a very long time to get through the entire spectrum. We're covering tens of gigahertz worth of bandwidth at once, and that means that we can be a lot more efficient, but it also means we need a lot more computing hardware there. So we've installed a new system at Greenbank, new system at Parkes, and we're developing new systems for future telescopes as well.
So, well, as you say, future telescopes, one question, why these particular telescopes?
So there's a variety of different ways you can go about searching for signals that would suggest that there is life beyond Earth. So I guess the main reason we want to use Parkes and Greenbank is because it fits our first observational strategy very well. So I think one of lots of interesting questions, but for me, one of the most interesting one is of the closest stars, how many of those have habitable planets and how many of those could possibly have an intelligent civilization on them? And if you're limiting yourself just to a close volume of stars, then you can do targeted observations where you take a telescope, point it at that star, take some data and see if you see anything. Mm-hmm. And with the large single dish telescopes that we're using, Greenbanks and Parkes, they have a very large aperture, meaning they collect a lot of light. But that also means that they have a very small field of view. So it makes them very good for targeted observations of stars. But if you wanted to do a survey, you might want to use a different instrument. So radio astronomy, radio interferometers, where you get lots of smaller dishes and combine their signals to make synthesized images. That approach we'd also want to use for a different survey strategy. And so the Breakthrough Listen program has three main goals. The first is to survey 1 million nearby stars. And then we want to do a survey of the galactic plane. And then we want to do a survey of the 100 nearest galaxies. And so with that, we get a large sampling of parameter space.
So one question. What type of signal do you look for? So how could you tell that signal would be from a civilization versus from, let's say, a mesa, for instance, which is also narrowband?
That's a very good question. And the answer is, of course, we don't know exactly what signal to expect. But the kind of class of signals we're looking for are things that are notably artificial in some way. So an example of that would be something that was very narrow in frequency, which if it was narrower than that you expect from spectral things and things like masers, and which have they're still very narrow bandwidth, but they're narrow on kind of kilohertz scales, whereas we look down to the hertz level.
So Doppler shifting bandwidth of your signals is also one of those signals.
That is
well.
One. So in terms of telling if a signal is artificial or not, you can look at very narrow band or like very high time resolution signals. In terms of telling if it's terrestrial or extraterrestrial, the main way you can do that is by using things like Doppler shift. So if a signal is based on Earth and you don't expect to see things like Doppler shift, because as the Earth rotates, the transmitter is also rotating at the same speed. Whereas if you have a transmitter in space as the Earth rotates, you do expect to see Doppler shifts. If you have a signal that's traversed a very long distance and is broadband, then you expect to see dispersion on the signal, where the propagation through the intergalactic medium means that you get a different time of arrival for different frequencies. So there are things that you would expect a extraterrestrial signal to have, just based on the literal physics of the signal transmission. But all we can really say is that we are looking for artificial signals, and we're looking through as much of the parameter space as possible. And we're trying to do that in using some more modern methods as well. So one thing I think is worth mentioning is there's a lot of work coming out of machine learning and deep learning. And some of those classification algorithms may end up being very useful for sifting through the large amounts of data we have.
I might have a question along those lines. If I understood well during your talk, you said that Breakthrough Listen data will be public as well.
Mm-hmm.
So are you thinking about maybe an updated version of SETI at Home or something like that, or create a civilian project like Galaxy Zoo to analyze this kind of data?
Our approach is different to SETI at Home and different to Galaxy Zoo. So with SETI at Home, they have a set of algorithms and they get you to download the screensaver, install it on your computer, and then your computer will then, whenever your screensaver is running, download some data and process that and then send the results back. And that's good if you want to do a class of algorithms which are very computationally intensive but have low bandwidth in requirements, because you have to send the data all throughout the internet. Given the data volumes we have with Breakthrough Listen, that paradigm, it doesn't map so well onto the problem. for us, it's better to try and use data locality and have the compute done as close to the data as possible. So with the data archive, we're making it open to everybody, but we also hope that we can provide some compute facility. So you, similar to a supercomputer, you can log on and do some of the data analysis there.
Okay, maybe ask for some times.
On the computer. With things like Galaxy Zoo, where you have some data and you're going through it, I think that is an interesting option to look through, but it requires a little bit more data processing to be done. So you need a little bit more richness in the data that has to be provided before the general public can just go and start clicking things. So I guess with the data archive, we want everyone who has any interest to just be able to download it. But we also want people who have specific skills, so from communications or from deep learning or astrophysicists who work on a different problem, we want to give them the ability to get the data and play around. And perhaps even not looking for signs of ET, but looking for new mitigation algorithms or exoplanets or anything like that.
Yes, of course.
I might just add that on this topic of analysis and software engineering, there's kind of a trend that, you know, much of the future of astronomy lies in software engineering or software, various types of algorithm development. And the wonderful and beautiful thing about being based in Berkeley or down in Mountain View, Moffett Field, in Silicon Valley, essentially, is that this is an epicenter for much of that type of work. And so one of our interests is not only to collaborate within the academic community internationally, but also with private industry when it comes to the development of sophisticated algorithms to tease out signals. Because the notion of collecting more data in order to analyze, you know, some may deem less important than understanding how to view the data that we perhaps have already collected. And so we aspire to run a program that really engages with the hearts and minds of software engineers in Silicon Valley. So
is this the software dogma? You say in your talk, you mentioned that introducing software Silicon Valley dogma into well, SETI and academics is one of the key initiatives as well. So that sounds really exciting. So one person in the meeting has, and this question is plaguing my mind slightly, is like they said, and you answered it, somebody suggested to wait 50 years for technology to improve before we could do it. Breakthrough isn't doing that. So my question for both of you, what do you think about that? I mean, so it's like, for the listeners, somebody suggested, like, since Drake did the first SETI experiment back in the 60s, astronomy and science has really moved forward, but SETI had stayed down. And it's only when technology started improving, then we start seeing more advancement in some of the sciences. So somebody suggested that maybe we just wait 50 years. And then when technology improves, we detect SETI instead of go through the next 50 years. So I would like to hear your opinions on that.
I think it's a little bit of a false dichotomy. We can do stuff in 50 years and we can do stuff now. And doing things now has the advantages of we can get some answers now and they may not be as good as they will in 50 years. But if you look at the progress of science, I mean, if we had done no science up to now and managed to get the technology to where it is now without going through all the hard work to make that technology. But if we just, you know, woke up one day and we had the better technology, then we could have done some of these extremely hard measurements that people spend their entire work life working toward answering could be done very quickly. But that's not the way it works. and I think it's important on many levels to innovate and to try and answer things now. In terms of like the next kind of 15, 20 years, the foreseeable future of astronomy, now is the perfect time to be doing SETI because we now know, thanks to Kepler and other missions, that there's a large amount of exoplanets out there and that, you know, basically every star has a planetary system and one in five stars has a planet that could be in the habitable zone. So we know that there's a good motivation to go out and start looking. And we do have very good technology now. And so with the single dish telescopes, we are getting the maximum that we possibly can without the next large increase in capability of the actual analog systems of the telescopes. So while it may be true in 50 years things will be better, I think doing things now is important, and also keeping the community alive. If you don't do anything for 50 years and then suddenly expect to be able to ramp up, that's just not how it works. Also, if we want to get onto the next generation of telescopes, like the Square Kilometer Array, we need to be doing things now to make sure that it's designed in to the system and that it's possible to create the data products that we would like.
Yes, I totally agree with you about these things.
I might just add that that there's also, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of easy to review what has been done. It's quite difficult to predict the future, perhaps impossible. But what we do know is a somewhat of a constant is luck is a variable that plays into a lot of what happens at times in science, and that you never know. There's kind of a serendipity of space exploration. You don't know what you're going to stumble upon. And there's been a great deal of discoveries anticipating perhaps a discovery in one field, but coming up with something else in some other field. Like fast radio bursts was perhaps one of those. So the time's right as well, because when one is presented with an opportunity of public interest due to the discovery of so many exoplanets and science broadening throughout the world, access to information and technologies, and the confluence of kind of monetary wealth in the private sphere, investing in fields that are deemed to be difficult to invest in with public funding because there's a very low chance of any substantial return on investment. Private money makes a lot of sense in those regards. You tend to invest in high-risk projects. And this is a high-risk program. And if there's a chance for return on investment, that's probably one of the most extraordinary returns on investment that humanity could ever possibly conceive of. So, and it's difficult to spend public money on programs like that. So that's the time's right financially as well, in a way.
One last question would be, so what should we, the viewer, or the listeners and the public, look forward to breakthrough?
Okay, well, so the main method we'll be using to kind of put yardsticks out is to show our progress is peer-reviewed publications. Mm. We're working at the moment on our first few publications coming out, which will be detailing the digital systems and the data analysis approaches we're using. But in the future, we're going to keep this very scientifically rigorous peer-reviewed path. And whenever we release something that is of interest to the public, we'll make sure that we also release a press release to say. But the thing that's going to happen in the next 3 years in terms of the observing program is we will survey all of the... We have the sample of about 1,500 nearby stars that we're looking at with the Green Bank telescope. And in the next 3 years, we'll complete that over all the different receivers on the telescope, and we'll be able to answer the question, out of those 1,500 stars, is there anything unusual about them in the bands that we're able to look at here from Earth? With Parkes, we're going to be doing a galactic plane survey, so using the receiver they have there that has a very fast survey speed to look at the galactic plane and see if there's anything unusual, any evidence of an artificial signal there. So I guess they're the two main data sets. After that, and going through the next 7 years of the breakthrough program, we'll be expanding from 1,000 to 1,000,000 stars, and also adding galaxies into the mix. And
you were also thinking about adding the Lovell telescope as well.
Well, we're hoping to get as large a fleet of telescopes as we possibly can that fit into our observing program. We need to be able to analyze the data as well, so we don't want to stretch ourselves too thin. But we're hoping to install some systems on the Lovell telescope and do some SETI here, get some SETI in the UK. We're here at the UK SETI Research Network. And so there are people who are... doing SETI in the UK, but in terms of observational SETI, where they're taking data, that's been a little thin on the ground just because there haven't been the opportunities to do so. We're also looking at using the Meerkat telescope in South Africa. We're very interested in that because that gives us a path toward the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array. And the Square Kilometre Array will be the premier radio telescope in the world at low to mid frequencies. And being able to do SETI on that would be very groundbreaking just because of its sensitivity.
One question I have to ask is, so how, as let's say someone listening to this, want to get involved in some level? You said public data, so eventually that will be there. So is there any other way, let's say, to someone very interested in getting moving forward in these things, if they want to get involved, how can they get involved?
Yeah, well, we're still in the first few stages of getting our public data archive up and running. But once we do, anyone can go and download the data, and we're trying to provide a toolkit to get some of the entry-level barriers. So, for example, you don't have to know too much about the file format. For the first few years, I expect that to really get involved, you'll have to have some acuity with computers. You may not need to know every single little bit about the telescope, but you will need to know how to write a simple script and how to plot data and things. So there will still be some technical hurdles for people, but at least in the short term. Longer term, we would like for as many people as possible to be able to access the data.
And probably education in schools eventually.
Yeah, so we have some people working on outreach. So for example, we have a guy in Berkeley, Steve Croft, is very interested in making sure that we maximize the outreach potential. And so we're trying to provide little tools and utilities so that schools and community groups can play around with the data and kind of understand a little bit more about how everything works.
I think that's it. And thank you, Jamie and Danny, for your time. I mean, it was very, very informative discussion. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.